Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm fine. Welcome to Jurassic Park.
Yay! It's the official July theme.
It's a catchy tune. I can't help but get that stuck in my head every time I watch this movie. Because it's so good. It's got the right amount of awe and mystery and excitement. And you know, there's still murder and things that happen.
Is it murder if a dinosaur commits it?
You're right. I believe that is man versus man's usurpation of nature. So
it's just chaos theory is what it is.
By the transitive property, is that really man versus man?
Because man created dinosaur?
Yes, and then Dennis Nedry let dinosaur loose, and then woman inherits the earth. So,
I mean, that part didn't happen yet. That should have been the sequel.
Ah, man, President Laura Dern, that would be something to watch.
Anything's possible. I have some questions about Dennis Nedry letting the dinosaurs loose. I don't know if you want to sequentialize this thing.
Let's seek it out, as they say.
I don't know what that means.
Seek, sequentialize.
Oh, gotcha. We'll okay, sure.
We used to have a command line tool that had seek in the name, and you'd use it for querying the sequences in a folder or something.
So I am unfamiliar with that tool, so I don't get your slang.
Yeah.
Is that a Unix tool?
Yeah, it was a Unix tool, but yes, we actually technically used it on Linux. Red Hat Enterprise Linux and CentOS.
Mm.
And then Fedora, because I think CentOS was not as updated as Fedora. But there you go.
What version were they running in this?
None of those things. There is actually a name for that 3D interface thing.
Is that a real thing?
Yeah, I always forget what it is. But it's real. You can look it up.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking it up. Part of it looked like some old Mac OS 8 or something. I don't know what was in there.
The window Chrome and stuff was Mac OS System 7. Because this is a movie from 1993, which is early. And
yeah,
a long time ago. You can even see that they're running this park on Macintosh Quadra 700s. So that's
right. There's some Macintosh hardware. There's some Silicon Graphics monitors.
Mm-hmm. It's just the perfect blend of park running hardware. You would definitely want to use.
Sure. I mean, you know, if you gotta debug a bunch of code, you want a nice system to work on.
Well, I mean, except debugging the code takes the system down, so locks may randomly start or stop working, or T-Rex paddocks might release T-Rexes. So.
Yeah, they spared no expense, except apparently when it came to memory,
classic Mac OS never had memory protection, so...
Or was that what that was supposed to be?
I'm sure that's exactly what that was supposed to be. It was an indictment of memory protection in the classic Mac OS environment.
Well, there's a subtle joke that I missed entirely.
Yes, as did literally everyone. But anyway, this is a good movie. This is a movie that I like. Not to spoil that with my initial assessment, but I like this movie quite a lot. I was so excited when this movie came out, and I begged and I pleaded for my mom to take me to go see this because she was a little worried that it might be a little too violent for me, but
with all of the non-murder.
Yeah, I mean, I was what, 10, 11, something like that. So yeah, that's she had valid concerns. Also, because if I was going, then that meant she had to take my sister and my brother, who were younger than me. So we made it a family affair, and we saw severed limbs and people being eaten. So
most of the blood is either off camera or just kind of downplayed a little bit. It's not like spraying blood everywhere.
No, I think the bloodiest thing in the movie is the severed goat leg. But yeah, I mean, this is not a gory film, I don't think, but it is violent still, in a sense, because there's a lot of like physical threatening things that are occurring.
Nature is violent.
Mm-hmm.
Can't be controlled.
It sure cannot. That is definitely not a thing that could happen. And that movie, this is the movie that teaches us that.
In case we weren't already aware.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Michael Crichton, for your consistent output of theme parks destroying things.
Wait, what were the other ones?
Westworld.
Oh, that's right.
The original stuff, not necessarily what you were familiar with from your HBOs.
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. We should talk about this sometime. It's a good show. Mm-hmm. Did you read the book?
No, of course not. I know a lot of people who did read the book and who loved the book and who would consistently point out all the things that the book did better than the movie. Apparently the book was darker and more violent than the film was. Like I think Hammond gets eaten by tiny little dinosaurs or something.
Was it two or three with a different guy, not Hammond, but somebody else.
Yeah, somebody else in the second movie gets eaten by tiny little dinosaurs. Spoiler alert for a horrible movie. Also spoiler alert, I don't like that one.
isn't that the Russian fella from Bad Boys 2?
I don't remember. We will get to that next week. For reasons that mostly have to do with,
well, it's Jurassic Park, so yeah.
Yeah, not mostly having to do with not having watched it right this minute. But this movie is a big, bold affair that changed the landscape of movie making for realsies and not just for play.
When you say it changed the landscape of movies forever, it means that from this point on forward, we have fantastic movies that use VFX in limited and very tasteful manners use them to support the story only. And we have great movies. From 1993 forward, every movie has just been fantastic.
No. No? See, what this movie did was go, hey, you don't have to use your little stop motion, go motion things. We got computers. And this movie manages to pull off some very tasteful things with that. There are
a movie that killed Go Motion.
there are some exceptions to that. Like, obviously, the technology is incredibly limited at the time that this movie was made, so you could not do a whole heck of a lot. And indeed, you see flaws in the resolution of the skin and the level of detail you can get in shadows and whatnot. Mm. But for the most part, because they're used so sparingly, I think it's something like there's something like 16 minutes worth of dinosaur footage in the film. And I think 9 of that is animatronic and the rest is from ILM. Mm. That's kind of lower than you might think because of the outsized way that they stick in your memory, but there's a lot of garbage that people have written in the last decade about how we need to go back to practical effects because of this movie, and and I just a lot of people are just wrong about things is what I'm saying.
I saw an extended commercial between, Jurassic World was on, and the commercial breaks, they would take like one whole commercial break and just make it like a behind the scenes featurette of Jurassic World 2. And, one of the entire, commercial break featurettes was focused almost entirely on the animatronic dinosaurs because audiences still have a thirst for practical effects, et cetera, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Except they use a lot of computers. I would say that computers and animatronics are tools, and that you're a tool if you don't use them correctly.
I was gonna make another equally inappropriate pun, but I won't do that. So, yeah, this here movie is really 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 good,
incredibly good. I think it is funny. It has really tense moments. It has like care and love between characters in here. It has strong protagonists who can save the day in a variety of ways by using their skills and knowledge to do that, not just bang, bang, shoot 'em ups. So there's a lot of really interesting things on display, and you kind of get the total package. And you get your John Williams score, which is, as I've said, beautiful. You get your Dean Cundey cinematography, which is always a delight for this sort of affair. You get Steven.
Did I see he has a cameo in this movie somewhere?
Sure.
Maybe. I thought I saw that on IMDb.
But you get your Steven Spielberg directing, and one thing he can really do is direct children, which I don't envy having to have that skill set, because I don't want them around me. Basically, I have the feelings that Dr. Grant has at the beginning of this film, and then those feelings haven't changed. But
well, you just need to be threatened with death by a dinosaur in order to show some love and appreciation for young children.
I just need to rappel down the side of a cement wall with a vine into a very deep chasm.
It was
that...
one of the broken.
One of the broken cables. Yeah, into the bottom of a deep chasm that didn't seem to actually really be there. nobody sent me the diagram of how the thing that the goat was standing on was really, you know, 4 feet over to the left or whatever.
I heard the line this time when I watched the movie. I heard the line that when he mentions we have the concrete moats installed to as a defense mechanism. So I heard that this time.
Yeah, except the moat doesn't have the other side. It's a tree.
What's a tree?
There's a tree.
In the moat?
No, on the other side. There's no other side of the moat, is what I'm saying. There's a concrete drop-off.
Yeah, I know.
It doesn't go back up again on the other side.
Oh, no. I think the moat runs perpendicular to the wall.
Oh. Is that how moats work?
Well, I mean, not entirely.
Yeah. No, it's one of those confusing things about the geography of this, that thing. And I know that there are people who have diagrammed it out and said, oh, it don't make sense. But, you know, like, that's where the holes in the cables are. So that's where the T-Rex came through. And the T-Rex was basically standing on the ground on the other side of that. So it doesn't make a lot of sense. You wouldn't even see over the top of that if he had been standing on the ground. Mm-hmm. Maybe he's perched on the tree and then broke through the cables. But
totally, sure. No, one of the things I appreciate about this movie, and watching it this time, I did my best to not get sucked into the movie for the entirety of the movie. There are parts where you just can't help get sucked into it. And try and figure out, like, what about this movie is... Not what about it is so great, because, like, everything about it is great, but, like, what about it is so different than maybe some of the less successful dinosaur movies that have come out in recent years?
You mean like, its sequels?
Yeah, all of the sequels.
Yeah.
And the whatever this new, I don't know, does Jurassic World count as a sequel or just, like, a different iteration or something? But one of the big things is they never really get real wide and spend a lot of time talking about the geography of the park or the anatomy of these cages or anything like that. Everything is, you know, relatively close to the humans, and from the perspective of, I mean, it's almost shot like a POV, even though they're not, like, addressing a character that is the camera. But they resist this urge to, like, widen out and explain the science behind the moat and the walls and the where everything is and how everything's laid out and the geography of, like, the distances between things. They don't bother because they know that stuff is unimportant, and they don't have, you know, Spider-Man cams flying across Main Street Margaritaville or whatever for no particular reason. It's all intimate with the characters, which is the most important part of this movie. And even to the point where it could be a little bit more objective in some of these scenes between dinosaurs and humans, it always sides with the humans just trying to deal with these forces, whether it be the weather, the cars, the dinosaurs. It kind of treats all of the other forces, you know, similarly, whereas the camera is always on the side, perspective-wise, of the humans. And I thought that was very interesting, and that's something that they definitely don't do in some of these other movies. You get to ride along with a lot of these dinosaurs in some of these later ones.
Yeah, and that's something you can see for sure happening. And it was I think I saw it on IMDb trivia or something like that. But basically, like Steven Spielberg wanted to have even a scene like the one where Ariana Richards and whatever his name is, the two kids, when they're looking from the Jeep up at the T-Rex, the reveal of the T-Rex is from their perspective inside of the Jeep. Mm-hmm. So the first time you see that T-Rex is from where they see it. So you're there with the kids seeing the T-Rex. It's not an omnipresent third-person view from outside of that, you know, like up in the air or flying through from the T-Rex to the car or anything like that. It's very much an intimate thing of you're here with these kids and, oh my God, there's a T-Rex on the other side of that glass. So that really sells a lot of the effect of the drama of feeling like you're in these scenes with these characters. Whereas I feel like you're saying, a lot of times lesser filmmakers might be tempted to pull out and show as much as they can, especially when they are not as restricted by technological issues. You know, in a lot of these cases, it's like you can't show the entire T-Rex because it's an enormous puppet. Incredibly dangerous puppet.
Also doing that, you know, lends the camera to a human scale too, like just avoiding those like massive crane shots to try and get a whole dinosaur in the frame with people too. It kind of breaks this illusion of just like showing just how massive these things are compared to the people. So every time you keep it like lower from a more human perspective or keeping the dinosaur mostly out of frame, it's just like, oh, these things are massive and you're just trying to avoid it. And I love the human perspective too, because it's really like in some of these later movies, they're almost doing like shot reverse shot scenes with the human and the dinosaur. It's like, ooh, what's the human going to do? And like, ooh, what's the dinosaur thinking the human is going to do? And they're like, it's like a subconscious battle of wits. And it's like, no, in this movie, the dinosaur may as well be like a tornado. It's just a big thing that wants to kill you. And just, it's just the human trying to like not get killed. With the minor exception of the raptor 2-on-1 scene there in the jungle, where they do get close to the raptors and try and give you a little bit of a hint that the raptors are smart thinking dinosaurs that understand a little bit, and getting that close and intimate with the raptor kind of gives you that feel that, like, you know, it's pulling one over on you know, button hat guy,
Muldoon. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this is a really well-crafted movie. Steven Spielberg, Dean Cundey, John Williams, the incredibly talented cast, all of whom I enjoy and like and all think contribute and do good things in the film. I especially enjoy Wayne Knight's Dennis Nedry. Mm. He's a lot of fun, even though he has very little screen time. Sir Richard Attenborough, it does a fantastic job as John Hammond. He's very believable as this kind of loopy, eccentric rich guy who wants to, you know, buck the bureaucracy and make his own system. He's
a dreamer and an optimist.
Yeah, he's also an entrepreneur. A little eccentric and delusional, but that doesn't come back to haunt him ever. You got your Sam Neill here as Dr. Alan Grant, who has some accent issues, but they're fine. He's a scientist. He's got his science-y stuff that he cares about deeply, and his discoveries and his work matters very deeply to him. Mm. You have his love interest, Laura Dern, who is a doctor in her own right and is a paleobotanist, very concerned with plants, and very complimentary to what you get from Dr. Alan Grant, where he may be gruff and all business, no fun. She's a little lighter, and you get
together. They're a mullet. He's the business in the front, and she's the party in the back.
I wouldn't necessarily call Laura Dern the party in the back, but she's great in this, and great in many other things. I feel like there was a point in her career where she just kind of like disappeared for a long time, and then she had a resurgence recently. So it's always good to see her. Jeff Goldblum, what is there to say about Jeff Goldblum?
In a landmark movie such as Jurassic Park, he is he might be the most iconic thing to come out of this movie.
He's incredibly interesting. And
and very, very odd. Just you wouldn't have thought to go this way with a character, would you?
Well, no, but that's what makes it interesting, is because he's so many like little idiosyncrasies. He's got the punk rock thing of the, you know, he's wearing all black leather and he's got his shades and whatnot. He has his little chortles to himself and his amusement, which lends a different sort of thing to his character than the other more serious scientists. So obviously nobody really takes what he has to say seriously. And he also is flirtatious with Dr. Sadler. So it's good to have him in here. And this is, of course, a very interesting character for him to play. Again, he also disappears for a large portion of this film. So, when you gotta go, you gotta go. And he went for a while, but they found him, and he was fine-ish.
Mostly fine. He used his own belt as a tourniquet on his leg. There's so much subtle detail in this movie that's so easy to overlook. Like, when they run up and find him, you remember that, like, oh yeah, he got knocked down, the other guy got eaten, and he was kind of buried under palm fronds. But, you know, Laura Dern has a brief line, and if you look down, you can see, like, he was alive and doing his own thing, and he was bleeding out of his leg, so he wrapped the belt around his leg as a tourniquet, and he mumbles, you know, remind me to tell John thanks for a great weekend or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, every line of it, like, and in the raptor scene earlier when they meet Muldoon for the first time, like, there's two conversations going on at the same time, and you can barely hear both of them, but it's all very important and useful information. It's not just, like, nonsense banter. Like, every bit of it is realistic and helps. It's all used so, like, it's so underplayed. It's crazy.
Yeah, and there's a he was also supposed to just run away out of the car like Gennaro does, but in the screenplay, but Jeff Goldblum talked Steven Spielberg into letting him do the flare gag too, and then running off. So it seemed a little more heroic than what he had tried to do before. So try to imagine
stupid,
this.
But
yeah. And so everybody in the audience is yelling at him not to do that, but at least his heart was in the right place. Whereas apparently in the original screenplay, he just runs. That would have seemed a little less heroic, and you would have probably liked him less than you do.
I mean, he doesn't really seem heroic in any part of this movie. He seems, he's not like a coward. He's not fleeing for his life at every moment, but he's definitely not like saving anybody.
No. Well, that's cause he got a little hurt.
And he almost ruins the getaway by leaning on the stick shift of the Jeep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's just, everybody has accidents when your leg's been bitten, but,
what's a guy to do when you're sitting in the back of the Jeep facing a T-Rex that's chasing you?
Yeah, objects in the mirror may be closer than they appear. You got Martin Ferrero as Donald Gennaro, which is interesting that rhymes. But he is the blood-sucking lawyer, and he is a lot of fun because he has such a boring straight man role to play in this, where he's not supposed to be interesting or someone that you like or identify with, and he is a coward, and he is sniveling, and he is looking to exploit this park for financial gain more than any form of discovery. So he gives you another point of view in the film that you otherwise don't have, and he has a very very unique ending, because I can't think of anybody else who's killed by a T-Rex eating them while they're on the toilet. Horrible and hilarious at the same time, so that's good.
Mm-hmm.
You got your BD Wong in here who resurfaces later as a mysterious scientist, but
he spends a lot of time erasing things off his clipboard.
Yeah, he's not really doing much, but he's a prominent title. I think he's in here for like 2 minutes. Then you get the kids, Joseph Mazzello, who apparently tried out to be Peter Pan for Hook. and even, you know, got brought in to do line readings and stuff, but he was considered to be too young for it. So Steven Spielberg said, "Don't worry, kid, I got something for you." And it was this. And then you got Ariana Richards, who plays Lex Murphy, who is, to this day, very annoying. I'm sorry, Ariana, please don't listen to our podcast. But
why is she annoying?
She's just so annoying. Like the screaming and the not being able to turn off a flashlight. There's not that many buttons on a flashlight. I don't get it. I just fumbling with that movie forever.
I thought you meant she continued on in life to be annoying.
No, I don't nothing about her in real life. I'm merely talking about the character Lex Murphy.
Gotcha.
And I mainly chalk that up to the writing, not her specifically, because of course she was written to not be able to turn off the light. That's not her making an acting choice not to be able to turn off the light. You're Samuel L. Jackson, who is had it up to here with these melon farming dinosaurs on his Mr. Falcon Island. But yeah, he's there.
Mm-hmm.
He has a severed arm
to his butt.
He says it twice. Mm-hmm. So butts are very important to him. Maybe that's just because he has so many cigarette butts.
It's his catchphrase.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think he came up with a catchphrase all on his own?
I don't know. Well, probably I'm going to assume that there was some writing involved because it was a movie, but maybe he pitched somebody on that and it's just never been recorded for history.
Mm.
And then everybody else I don't really think is important in here. Sorry, people. Sorry,
what
Bob Peck.
Dodgson.
Dodgson was tried and convicted recently, like a couple years ago, for running an acting class thing where he took advantage of underage girls.
Oh my God, really?
Yes.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah, well, most people don't know that. I just remember because I saw the news article described, Jurassic Park actor, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, well, which one could it possibly be? Because all the other ones are important. And it turned out it was him.
Mm.
He's not a good person. So it makes it very difficult to watch that scene where he's trying to do the comedy straight man bit with Wayne Knight. And Wayne Knight is, of course, having a ball. Putting the shaving cream on somebody else's
pie. Squeaking the way he does. No, I was going to compliment Mr. Dodgson on the way he, like, skulked out of that taxi cab without closing the car door, and the cab driver behind him, like, kind of, like, flipped him off, but I don't think I want to give him credit anymore because he's bad.
Yes. Well, I mean, he wasn't a good person in the film, tough context either, so there you go. And you really get... a lot of fun stuff in here, and the rest of the cast doesn't matter because they all leave on a boat, so we never find out who they are. And
do you think that it was implied that there was a large cast beyond what we saw in the movie? I feel like they were all sort of like running in skeleton crew mode because they're still like startup.
It did seem like they didn't have that many people, but at the same time, they had people whose job it was to like open Jeep doors. So I feel like they had some more crew than maybe they ought to have had for certain tasks.
You don't think Hammond was like, you know, let's really roll out the red carpet for these guys because their opinion matters. So like, John, I know you run the cafeteria or whatever, but can I borrow you for a day to like open the helicopter doors and the Jeep doors, make it big, like a big presentation out of it?
That could have been it. They could have been retasked from their I don't know, dino dropping jobs.
Keeps saying they spared no expense, but I feel like after watching this movie, they may have spared a few expenses.
Well, he spent a lot of money, but the thing is, he spent it on automation, which he points out himself was a flaw, and that next time there won't be automation.
More people that can stab you in the back if they're not compensated appropriately.
Apparently, yeah, it is. Strange that Dennis Nedry holds so much power over all of this, but he does. And the other strange thing is that the storm that is hitting this island is a major part of the film, and it is what causes basically everything to go awry, from Dennis Nedry to everything else. Is everything backfires because there's a storm that hits them. If there had not been a storm, Dennis Nedry would have been safely off the island with his shaving cream foam embryos, and they'd be off on their way to doing stuff.
I like to think of it more the other way around. Like, if Dr. Grant had showed up like 2 days later and everything else had been the same, they would have just landed and the dinosaurs would be running amok and all the humans would be dead.
Well, yeah, but maybe they wouldn't have flown to the island with special guests if they couldn't contact the island. They probably would have done something else first. But yeah,
somebody probably would have been like, oh, the phones are probably down. We'll fly out there anyway. It'll be fine. Don't worry about it.
What was weird was they evacuated literally everyone except for Arnold, Muldoon, Hammond, and the people on the tour.
I thought part of that was because, like, when they jump on the radio there, when they're checking out the Triceratops, he says, like, last boat for the mainland leaves in 5 minutes. It's like, well, who's going to get there in 5 minutes?
Yeah, but we never see those people. So they must have made it. And also, it wasn't really 5 minutes since the boat guy was waiting for Nedry for some indeterminate period of time.
Right, so that's what I wanted to ask you about, because the boat guy says, like, 10 minutes or something, and Nedry's like, I need 20, minimum 15, can you stall him or something? Did Nedry always plan to shut down all of the electrified fences as part of his, like, cover-up plan, or did he shut those down so he could take a more direct route to the boat to get there faster, which was his undoing and everyone else's undoing?
I think it was mainly to get to the boat, because there were the perimeter fences and stuff that he needed to have disabled so that he could drive the Jeep through. Remember when he gets out and he opens the gates and drives through the gates?
And yeah, they were like, why did he shut off everything except the Raptor fences?
Yeah.
But so that's the reason. I was curious because I had never thought that perspective before watching it this time, that maybe he shut down a few more fences because he was trying to get to the boat more quickly because he had a shorter timeline than he had planned for. And he's like, whatever, I'm not coming back here. Shut it all down.
Yeah, also, I'm sure he wanted to sow chaos, but maybe he felt like he could reasonably get away from anything else that was threatening except for the raptors in his Jeep in the amount of time that he had left on the island. I'm assuming that was his thinking behind unlocking things like the T-Rex and the Dilophosaurus's. But maybe he shouldn't have done that. Tip for next time. For next time you're trying to get off an island full of deadly dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. Maybe leave all the deadly ones locked up, and you can just have the chaos from the herbivores running amok.
You think he's got like a tag filter that he can sort like lethal versus non-lethal dinosaurs, so he can turn off certain cages and not other ones?
Well, I mean, he knew where the raptors he needed to not turn off, so I'm going to assume he, at the very least, could hard code in whichever one he wanted.
And while I do mention that they don't really spend a lot of time showing you the geography of the where things are in relation to the other buildings, one thing that's pretty clear is that the Raptor paddock is very close to the control center. So he probably definitely didn't want to do that for that reason, because he drives past it on his way to work every day.
Yeah. I have to feel like everything involving the Raptors was an oversight.
It's a very small paddock, too, by the way.
Yeah, well, especially if you had, like, what was it? It was 8 or something before the female they introduced killed all the other ones. But the weird thing about that is I'm not sure why they decided to breed them, because you can't really see or interact with these. You can just watch a cow get devoured. So it's peculiar.
There's probably not a like a 12-inch thick plexiglass wall below that staircase where the visitors are going to walk by and look through at the raptors, right?
No, you know, and I don't think they come out for the raptor show where they have them in the big pool they're jumping for the little fish.
How thick do you think the glass was in the Mosasaurus tank in Jurassic World, given that the piece of glass was, what, like 100 yards long?
I'm going to guess it was made up BS width. Mm-hmm.
It's very strong glass. It's capable of holding back CGI foot-pounds of water.
Yes, because everything in that movie looks so real. No, but One thing I do like, since you're mentioning the architecture, I really do like the production design of this. It feels like a theme park. And indeed, if you go to Universal Studios, you can still see Jurassic Park the stuff, although now apparently they've rethemed it to be about Jurassic World because they're jerks. But
was the main visitor center thing there somewhere?
In Islands of Adventure in Universal Studios, Florida, they had a visitor center. It was a smaller scale version of the one that you see in the film.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah. It was, of course, not as big as the one you see here, but it is... when you see them pull up in their cars, you see the landscaping and just an enormous visitor center, and they walk inside this big lobby. Like it feels really just like a theme park. Like this is what they were setting out to do.
And I love the design inside too, where like even the pillars have sort of like bone, like skeletons carved into them, just to sort of like fossils. Decoration. Yeah, yeah. It's all very like Rainforest Cafe, but dinosaur themed. And I can't stress enough how much I love that there aren't these like ridiculous wide shots showing off the building, because the building is not the important part. Like the production design is amazing in every part of this movie, and it takes some serious restraint to not go like, well, why don't we just widen out a little bit more so we can, you know, show off a little bit more of our production value here and let everyone see the work that Joe did over there on that thing there. That's very cool looking. Well, and they didn't bother with any of that because it's unimportant to the story.
They do have a wide shot when they pull up in the Jeeps, though. So you do see the entire building.
The building is not the subject. It's a wide shot showing the people pull up and then get out and walk up the stairs. So it's functional. It's not like, again, I hate to continue to crap all over Jurassic World, but it's not one of the seven like Skycam flying over all of the building shots. It's like, look at our downtown. Up here on this hill is where we have our control center, and over there is a helicopter pad. It's like, nobody cares. This shot is unimportant.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it still manages to have awe in it, even for simple things like you're walking upstairs. Well, guess what? It's a spiral staircase that goes around two dinosaur skeletons. And then when you get to the top, you go on your little tour, and there's a video playing with Richard Attenborough talking to himself, and you get your Mr. DNA animated sequence, which is apparently an idea that Steven Spielberg had, because they had some exposition they needed to get through. So what better way to do it than an animated character on an annoying tour?
Oh man, I want to make... No, I can't do this parody video because it would be impossible and require too much effort. The projector should come on, and on the screen instead of that video, it should be a video of Margot Robbie in a bathtub explaining how DNA splicing works.
I'm not sure you can afford Margot Robbie's time in the way that they could on The Big Short, but
we'll just dub it over. We'll just like animate her mouth, and I'll have somebody else do the dialogue.
Yeah.
Remember how none of the continuity matches in The Big Short? Nobody will notice anyway.
No one will notice. But anyway, I like Mr. DNA and the whole sequence that exists there, because it explains to literally everyone what the whole thing is about. You got your Amber with your mosquitoes, which have dino blood, but the dino blood is not viable enough to use by itself, so they use frog stuff, and that comes up later. But this explains the whole thing pretty elegantly in a way that you would have to explain it to people who are going to this theme park. Mm. So it doesn't feel like it is out of character of the film.
And Hammond and Gennaro are sitting in the back there, and they're enamored with the idea of the ride. And you get the scientists up front who are having their minds blown by the science. And it couldn't be more clear that Hammond's in his little dream world where he's not even thinking about the practical ramifications of what he's doing, and all the scientists are just like, no, not only is this so serious that we need to know more, like, we're going to break your ride and get off of this so we can go get answers.
Yeah, and when they do break out of there and go to witness the birth of the tiny, tiny baby raptor, you get your first real shot of some dinosaur stuff going on up close, because up to this point you had the threatening scene with the raptor, which is not really on camera at the beginning, and you had the scene where they pull up and Alan Grant forgets how to take off sunglasses, and they look at the long neck getting tree stars, and that's your big impressive moment up to this point. And now you got this tiny little baby. So,
mm-hmm.
And it puts, and like you said, with human scale, like this is literally something that is incredibly deadly, but it's just so tiny and it's in your hand.
Mm-hmm. And then you have Dr. Malcolm give his famous speech.
Yeah. Just because stuff they did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mumbling to himself, and nobody is really paying any attention because they're all in awe that they're holding baby raptor. And oh God, it's all so good. It's all, I feel like this is incredibly obvious and stupid to say, but I don't think anyone other than Steven Spielberg could have made this movie. I think we have four other movies that kind of prove that, but just
wait, halt. Just so you know.
Yeah.
Before the book was published, Crichton demanded a non-negotiable fee of $1.5 million as well as a substantial percentage of the gross. Warner Brothers and Tim Burton, Columbia Pictures and Richard Donner, and 20th Century Fox and Joe Dante bid for the rights. But Universal Studios eventually acquired them in May 1990 for Spielberg.
Mm, oh boy.
Could you imagine Tim Burton's Jurassic Park?
So many
curly Q things and spirals and stuff.
I was trying to think of the Joe Dante Jurassic Park more than anything else.
Well, you see, they put on makeup and little costumes and they start dancing in the lobby. And then one of the dinosaurs would pop through the wall and there'd be a dinosaur-shaped hole in the wall.
Boy.
Joe Dante is so interesting. But yeah, also, I mean, I guess Richard Donner, I don't know what that would be. It was just a little strange. But Spielberg was definitely the right person for this. And apparently, James Cameron also wanted to do this. But after seeing it, was like, you know what? It was right, the right thing that Steven Spielberg did this one, because apparently, according to him, like, kids deserve to have the awe and mystery of dinosaurs, and what he would have done would have just been like aliens with dinosaurs. so he was like, you know, it's probably a good thing I didn't do that.
Yeah, I think just Spielberg's incredibly like human emotional approach to every scene and shot and set piece is just, it's really what makes this thing work. Just that the perspective of the entire movie being with these characters and what these characters are feeling, like even in that end helicopter ride where ostensibly the emotion in the helicopter is, well, this is depressing, a lot of people died, my dream is dead, we narrowly escaped with our lives. But the primary focus of the actual shots is like that look between Laura Dern and Sam Neill, where he's like got his arms around the kids. Like it's about the people again and their arcs.
Yeah. And also, I really love the helicopter in this movie.
Yes, I know.
I thought it was the coolest thing when I was a kid, because like the wheels fold up into the belly of the helicopter and then you get like this perfectly little streamlined helicopter thing.
Yeah, it's got the forward facing seats and the rear facing seats.
Mm-hmm. And the buckles, except for that one that mm-hmm. Grant has. And it has the hokey drop that they do with the rear screen projection stuff.
Yeah.
But you know, the waterfall approach and all that is just gorgeous to look at.
Mind that there's a continuity break where like Richard Attenborough has his back to the front of the helicopter and they're flying at the island and he looks out the right side of the helicopter and goes, there it is. And it's like, yeah. What is?
Mm-hmm. Well, so good. I mean, yeah, there are a lot of minor errors in here, I would say.
All completely forgivable, too.
Yeah, because it's so good around it that you're not focused on the error. That's one of the key important things to errors. You can mess up as much as you want to. As long as everybody's really bought into the movie, they're not going to stop and notice and care.
Yeah, it's weird, too, because a lot of the errors are on like a, even like a shot level, just like, how are we going to execute this shot? And, you know, we got to do certain things to make this look right, feel right, whatever. And they do that. And then you back out to like a scene level. And then somehow all of those shots that have, you know, mistakes in them for their own sake work together as a scene. And then you back out even further and all of these scenes with their minor mistakes that somehow manage to work together, somehow work together as an entire movie. It's just, it's incredible how all of this just fits together so perfectly.
Yeah. A mistake that I had never noticed in like decades of watching this until Todd Vaziri first started tweeting about it was there is a missing frame of the raptor inside of the T-Rex's mouth at the end of the movie. Like literally the raptor just turns off for a frame.
It's in the shot where he flings the raptor. Is that right?
Think so. Yeah, it's just in his maw, and then blink, it's gone for 1/24th of a second. This is just missing from the film.
I tried to look for it this time in real time, and I couldn't see it.
No, I mean, this is one of those errors that you just can't see in real time. But I guess that's what happens when you used to do film dailies for VFX.
When you can't pause on the frame.
Yeah. Well, you can't pause on the frame because you'd burn through the film, but nowadays you can step through that, and then you can do something that is referred to as pixel effing, which is fun.
What? Never have. Oh, I found the link to Todd's thing. I put in the chat room.
Oh, good.
Oh yeah, 25th anniversary of this movie, man. 25 years.
Hard to believe, really, because it still feels what while. The 90s-ness of this is there for sure. It still has a very fresh feeling to it in pace and, in general execution, I would say. I really think that there's, if you just changed very little about this, you could have a very good contemporary movie, if you were to do it today, whereas Jurassic World did not take that approach, but
what would you do? You would modernize the technology in the visitor center so there's holograms and things.
Absolutely not. But
giant rolling marbles that guests can drive around in.
Oh God. Our member Slack, for those who are listening and are not familiar. The Incomparable has a membership thing, and part of that is a perk where you get to sign into a Slack, which is a chat room where people can share things, and there is a hashtag defocused chat room. And in there, TM Trains, friend of the show, listener TM, has shared a video game clip of a Jurassic World Evolution video game, and it looks so awful, like just awful, awful. Incredibly bad, like no shadows, but you can drive around in those little sphere things. They're inside the trailer for some reason. They don't cast any shadows or go near a stegosaurus that casts any shadows when he's rolling over grass.
Everything's got to be franchised and gamified now.
It's so frustrating.
The Verizon Wireless presents the Indominus Rex. Is that what it was?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's something you can kind of chuckle at, and I believe we mentioned that when we were doing the episode about it. Like the part where there's corporate sponsorship, you can chuckle at, and like that's a joke
when they call it out, except for the parts where they don't call it out.
Yes, but then it is a victim to its own corporate sponsorship things because it is throughout the film. So it's not just that you don't get the credit for the joke if you're also like, you know, totally doing it, but which I believe is literally what we said when we talked about that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, I deeply regretted that we couldn't talk about this film because I like this one, and we just had to go straight into the poop, and we did. We went right into the dino droppings.
We waded elbow deep into the dino droppings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. No, but. Like this is a really enjoyable, beautiful film, full of really interesting stuff and incredibly, just absolutely fascinating things that your mind will turn over after you've seen it. Where you're just witnessing this world that they wanted to make and the awe-inspiring nature or in nature of it, where you could have this theme park with your Ford Explorers going around on the tracks and the voice of, was it Richard Kiley or something? Although there is that very funny video now where somebody just dubbed in Kylie Minogue into the Kylie Minogue video. Can't get you out of my head.
Yes, that's it's a good one.
I like that. And you get your Jeep Wranglers, your Saharas or whatever, and they got the big old emblems on the side and stuff. Mm-hmm. Like you just see this and it feels like a fully realized idea of a place. It doesn't.
When they do that close up of all of the merchandise in the visitor center and the camera dollies past to see Richard Attenborough eating the ice cream, like just the thought that went into the merchandise there just makes it instantly feel real. You're like, of course they would have lunch boxes and thermoses and t-shirts and it would look exactly like that and they would be for sale right there.
Yeah, right there in the visitor center, right next to the cafeteria that they have. And the beautiful mural on the cafeteria wall, which is very nice to look at, but also has just the imagery of the shadow of the raptor overlapping the painting of the raptor is like burned into my brain from having seen this when I was a kid. It is one of the like most genius things you could have done, because you've just been looking at this mural of dinosaurs the entire time, so why not just have your spooky here's a real one come in with a shadow. So I mean it is design that you really could you find believable, but also is beautiful in a storytelling sense for specifically this film.
And you know, it's those sorts of things where it's like a different director or a different producer or whatever would come in from a different perspective and say, like, all right, let's just think through, let's build the world of what Jurassic Park / world would look like and what would be in the visitor center, what would be here and there, and not really think about, like, you know, what does that mean for the storytelling? Let's build it. Let's build this world. Let's do our world building in our set design, in our vehicle design, whatever, all of this stuff. And then within that, then we'll go find where we're going to shoot. We'll set our camera angles here and stage our characters there. But like all of the pieces that are built of the world in this are specifically there because they add to the story. And it's like, whether you're focused on it or not, that's they're there and they add to it. It's crazy.
Yeah. And specifically the gift shop part, we don't see the gift shop before the scene in which, Attenborough is eating his ice cream, lamenting the situation that he's gotten himself into. And we're kind of going over all of this merchandise in like a really forlorn way. Like, oh, this was supposed to be, this big thing for kids. And this was supposed to be a big, attraction. This was supposed to be me proving to the world that I could really do it. And you hear his speech about that, about how he used to have this automated flea circus thing and he wanted to do it for real this time. And no tricks.
It is literally the opening frame to the scene where his dream is dying.
Yeah, it's really a clever way to do it. And he acts the crap out of that scene. Just him with his little pint of ice cream talking to Laura Dern in an empty cafeteria with the gift shop that they just panned over. And then she takes a bite of that ice cream after she lectures him and says it's really good ice cream. So it's, it really... Mm-hmm. Makes you feel like everybody is just full of regret in that scene, in that moment, where not, this couldn't have been the dream.
Yeah, and it's not just that they were saving the you know, the gift shop for like this reveal, or it was a cheap ad or something, but like you almost feel the withholding. Like, what was that weird room that they had lunch in earlier with all of the projector screens around them? They were almost just like, here's a bunch of imagery for our dream of selling this place to people, but we're not even going to show you the place. It's basically just a black room that falls off to nothingness because the only thing that matters is literally what's happening around this table.
The slides that they're projecting provide ambiance in the sense that there's this sort of atmospheric quality to the way that's shot. You're not looking at... The point is not what's on the slides. The point is just the conversation that they're having. And like you're saying, it just falls off to nothingness. And it's a very serious conversation about what their role is in everything. Of course, that's my favorite line. One of my favorite lines, the only one on my side is the bloodsucking lawyer. That's nice. But yeah, that's the kind of thing where it's very effective storytelling in the way that it's staged and shot and the way the production design serves it. And I don't know how much of that was Steven Spielberg saying, I specifically need this room with these slide projectors where I can do this, or I want the cafeteria, but it's not available, so we're going to do this. But like, it was a very clever way to do that. I think there's
got to be some intent there with some juxtaposing of the very serious conversation in the dark room with these particular images, because the images are so benign. Like, the, you know, you see the airplane that is very crudely photoshopped to look like it's coming out from behind like the palm trees of on the edge of a beach or whatever. You can almost see that that particular image as like the title card that pops up during like the Price is Right when they're talking about like what prize you're going to win. It's like, an all expenses paid trip to Jurassic Park. It's just, it's so just like, it's part of their marketing campaign and all of these things that Hammond had been focused on before, even like, because he never got around to thinking about the implications of all this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
So good.
Yes, it's really good. And back to like performances and stuff like that and staging, you even get that in moments like when Gennaro is going to visit the mine and he very intentionally slips, not the character intending to, but it was staged so that he would, and that he's on uncertain footing and doesn't really is not comfortable in the mines. And then for some reason you have everybody in the mine stop work because they found one mosquito, and they all gather around to look at it, which
well,
doesn't
like get paid a lot of money when they find one of those.
Yeah, I guess, but it doesn't make a lot of sense that you're just like, halt all work and everyone crowd me right now.
Well,
but
I thought that was because he didn't have enough light to see through the amber with one thing, that he needed everybody's like helmet lights on.
Well, he got a couple more lights, but he didn't need like all those people who were behind him who were not contributing anything. That was definitely just because that was about the staging of that to be very dramatic, of having all of these people filling out the scene.
So, pretty Indiana Jones.
Yeah, it was very Indiana Jones. And you get even some of that stuff of the terror of staging these things on like soundstage stuff, where it's like, here's our tree that's not really a tree with a Jeep in it, and you know, we gotta run out of there, so we'll make this
the
as
Jeep
dramatic
falls
as possible.
Straight down, despite the fact that it would immediately fall out of the tree if that was real, but it doesn't
right.
matter.
Doesn't matter because it's all fake. You get your morning with your brachiosaur, brontosaur, whatever. And you get all this fun, beautiful stuff, where it makes you appreciate in all of this terror, all of the interesting things that could possibly be happening.
And it's all in the eyes of the people and the awe that they're feeling and the terror that they're feeling. And it's just, it's all from the absolute correct emotional perspective all the time.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Mm. Did you look at Seth's Jurassic Park clock that went up, I don't know, a week or two ago?
I had meant to do that before I re-recorded, because I know that Seth really cares, but I didn't.
I did. It's good. We should put a link in there for other people to go look at.
Yeah.
It's
for those who are not aware, sometimes guest of this podcast, Seth Worley, who is a director in his own right, and has a little side business called plotdevices.co, does these little story clock things, which I had first seen him do in a video where he was talking about how perfect Indiana Jones is, and he had plotted out on a circle, this happens in this act, and this happens in this act, and you could see the way that things interrelated in terms of pacing from a unique point of view. Not that anybody really needs to construct a movie in that way, but just that it was an interesting way to look at it and explore it from another perspective. And so he does that periodically now, where he does other films, including Jurassic Park.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which, though he may say that Twister is his favorite movie, I think this might actually be his favorite movie.
Yeah, I mean, if it was really his favorite movie, he would have been here. But no,
well,
he's going to be on for Twister.
Yeah, he's not allowed to come back for anything except Twister.
No, just Twister.
Which,
only Twister.
It probably won't be this year, because I don't think there are any months that rhyme with Twister or anything related to Twister.
I'm sure we can think of something. I mean, this was a stretch. But yeah, this is a real beautiful, wonderful movie from every point of view and perspective. And I like the competency of all these characters, particularly the well-written female characters who have skills and abilities that aren't necessarily eclipsed by the other men around them. Specifically Laura Dern calling out sexism of Attenborough, trying to like protect her. And you even get that with the kid, Lex, who is a hacker. She says several at one point in the film.
Not a nerd. She prefers the term hacker.
Yeah. And she is the one who manages to get the door locks working because she can overcome her fear and use her actual skills to do something. So it's a very inspirational kind of a thing. Like, this is not Chris Pratt shows up and then just lectures a dinosaur into submission about how you remember me, Blue. You remember me, Blue, for like 45 minutes.
Yeah, Laura Dern does not show that she has agency by doing all of these things in high heels.
No. And her first initial outfit in this movie is incredibly regrettable.
It's just denim all over the place.
It's a Canadian tuxedo, but with like a blossom hat.
Well, you know, it was pulled down because, you know, the helicopter was blowing dust everywhere.
Yeah, it was unfortunate. But the fortunately, she goes on to wear the iconic outfit of the tied shirt with the little tiny shorts and the boots, the big old boots. Mm-hmm. And she's kicking butt and limping through hallways and things. Whatever happened to the light that was on the end of that cord that was dangling behind her while she's limping, but then she gets to the door to the outside and there's no light anymore?
It either got slammed in the door of the building or slammed in the door of the fence that she closes.
But there wasn't a cable anymore, so she must have just like completely taken it off.
Yeah.
Continuity. Well, I guess we have to say that this is a bad movie now.
Yeah, it's a bad movie because the flashlight. What happened to the flashlight?
Yeah.
It disappeared for more than a single frame.
Flashlights are really the downfall of this movie because you got the one with the T-Rex. It's really, you know, breaks believability. Nobody could turn that off. And you got this one that disappears when she's going down the hallway and then she's outside and she doesn't have one.
This is why UX design is, you know, It saves or costs lives. Like if the power on off button of these flashlights and or the size for carrying them were more reasonable, more you know, usable for the people, they would not have been attacked by the T-Rex and she would not have been you know, slowed down by it when she was escaping the raptor.
Yeah, it's really an oversight of the manufacturers who are behind these products.
Mm-hmm. Maybe in the next one.
How much did you want those IR goggles, though?
They're pretty cool, but every time, like when they show the POV through the goggles, and he's like, "Cool night vision," I'm like, "You can't see anything through those. Those suck. Like, you need better night vision if you're actually going to show off night vision."
What's funny is he's wearing it and he's looking at the empty spot where the goat used to be. But then it cuts to Lex, who says, "Where's the goat?" Because so she can see it without those on, anyways.
The night vision goggles don't do anything. Maybe it's just because it's like a relatively well lit area in front of the paddock. Who knows?
Yeah, it just makes everything green. But yeah, it was still toyetic, I would say.
Yeah, it's a good thing. Good thing they really brought that back for the callback in Jurassic World. That was very effective and helpful. Oh, speaking of, I wanted to bring that up. In the in this one, the visitor center, we get a very clear indication that the visitor center is up, what, like 10, 15 steps?
Sure.
In Jurassic World, there are no steps. There's just a door.
Well, maybe...
Are we to believe that in 15 years, so much natural mud and dirt piled up to cover all of those stairs?
It seems like they have a lot of storms.
I guess there was a lot of muck that came down the little waterfall that covered up the Barbasol can, but I disagree with that.
Fun story. They used all of the fire extinguisher, fire hydrants on the Universal lot to try to get as much water as they could to flow down.
Mm-hmm.
It still was not enough water for Steven Spielberg, and he feels like that scene needed more water than it had.
For the rain or the waterfall?
Well, the water that was coming down from where the Jeep was.
Mm.
And if you pay attention to when they cut back and forth, there is rain in some shots and not as much in other shots. But that's just how the rain machine crumbles. But
I would say the waterfall seemed like it had an acceptable amount of water. I wouldn't say it had a torrent of water coming down it.
No, apparently Steven Spielberg wanted more, but he didn't get it. It was all the water they could get.
Sometimes you just got to work within your constraints as a filmmaker.
Yeah. You accept the things you can't change and something, things you can.
They spent all their money on giant mounds of fake poo.
Mm. Well, did you know that was clay and straw? And then it didn't smell at all, but they covered it in honey and papaya juice so that it would attract flies.
That's, I did not know that. That's interesting.
Isn't that? That's how you make movie poop, everybody.
That's a top tip.
Mm-hmm. When you need to make your dinosaur poop mounds at home, just do what they did in this film. Although I would actually omit the honey and the papaya because I don't really want flies buzzing around me.
Yeah, you could.
As odd as that is to admit.
You could get the flies in audio. A lot of people just do that. They make the sound of flies and it implies it enough for people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, or you could just get Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah, I mean... The way he struts up to the pile too is just so great. He's got the jacket off. He's just got the unbuttoned shirt, just kind of strolling up.
You're gonna wash your hands, are you?
Are you eating thing?
So good,
oh, boy. Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah.
Excited for his comeback.
Well, we'll see how you feel about that next week.
Oh no, I didn't mean next week. Yeah, I know that one.
There's several comebacks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It looks like he's sitting on a J.L. Fisher dolly in this shot, Mr. Spielberg.
Oh. Is that a dolly that you're familiar with?
I enjoy the J.L. Fisher dollies. I am less a fan of the Chapman dollies.
Oh, I'm sorry. What's the other one? The Panther whatever? I forget the name of that one.
Well, those are the two primary brands. There are different types of dollies.
Hmm.
But... I think I know which one you're talking about. I can't remember specifically, though.
Yeah. It's for some special effects thing. I can't remember.
Mm. Special effects.
Yeah. And I said that instead of visual effects because I did that on purpose. Nobody write at me any letters. I know the difference.
Are you sure?
I can hear you writing letters. Stop it.
Dear Mr. Rosensteel.
As you may not be aware, sir... The feel is called visual effects. One last thing that's iconic to this film is the sick Triceratops.
Yeah.
Itself. There was a big animatronic and had that big air bladder that inflated.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
By the time we were done watching it and it was really only moving its like left paw forward a little bit, it did feel a little bit animatronic, but it was really nice animatronic.
Yeah, but it led to, I think, a resurgence in traveling dinosaur animatronic shows.
Wait, what?
Well,
is that a thing?
The science center near me in Tampa, Florida, we had several dinosaur things that would come through town, and it'd just be like a bunch of animatronic dinosaurs. Of course, they were not as good as this film, and they did not have the range of motion or performance that they had in this film. But you'd still go see it because it was a dinosaur that moved. And they were all, you know, latexed and painted and stuff to look like what they thought that dinosaurs would look like. And of course, shortly after this film, they discovered that raptors would actually have feathers. But also, when they were filming this film, Steven Spielberg wanted a 10-foot-tall velociraptor, but they are not actually that big. So they just did it anyways. And then scientists uncovered the Utah raptor, which is actually 10 feet tall.
Which one's 10 feet tall in this movie?
All of them, when they stand up straight.
Mm. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
There seems to be a little variation in the size of the raptors in this one. Like the one that, probably just because it had to be the most articulate one, the one that actually eats Mr. Muldoon, you can get a pretty good view of it through the foliage there, and it doesn't look as good as some of the other ones.
No. That is a shot that could have used some more foliage.
When Timmy hits the ground after he gets electrocuted, he's covered up pretty well, which is good.
Yeah. Oh, here we go. Cameron Thor. That's the guy's name.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bad guy.
Thor.
I'm not going to read the things he was charged with because they're horrible and disturbing. So, anywho, what else is there left to say about this other than it like changed movie making
for all time? Yeah, I don't know. I'm honestly shocked we found an hour's worth of stuff to talk about because this movie is just so good that it's like it's hard to get into too much detail or like critique anything in particular. It's just fanning all over it. Although, it only has an 8.1 out of 10 on IMDb, so I don't know who those people are who rate it low.
They're fired, all of them. They're not allowed to use IMDb anymore.
68 Metascore.
What is wrong with people? I can't think of a more universally appealing film than this.
Okay, here you go. If you click on the Metascore, Mr. J. Scott from the Globe and Mail Toronto said it's a perfectly passable kiddie escapism. It has a thrill or two, a chill or three, but has no poetry, little sense of wonder, no resonant subtext, no art. When it's over, it's gone extinct.
What a bozo.
Kenneth Turin from the Los Angeles Times said all the imagination and effort, including 18 months of pre-production that went into making the dinosaur state of the art, exciting, apparently left no time to make the people similarly believable or involving. In fact, when the big guys leave the screen, you're tempted to leave the theater with them. June 11th, 1993.
Oh.
Hopefully he got fired from the Los Angeles Times because that is a terrible review.
That's an awful review. I mean, I hope that all of these people have just had to live with their wrongness for 25 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would hope Fools. So. This is one of the best movies of all time.
I would agree that it's not, in addition to being influential, it is also just such an incredibly well-rounded thing that it's just so hard to like find an actual fault with it. Now you could say, oh, it's not that deep, but it's like, I don't know, it's like, how are you going to make this thing appeal to so many people? Like, I think this does it perfectly, and with poetry as opposed to that commentary from the idiot up in the Great North. Idiots. But yes, this is a good film, and makes me, you know, all the more remorseful about what came after.
You can understand the temptation and why they made so many sequels, but none of them come even close.
Nope. And also, I'm saying that without having seen the most recent one, which is, as we're discussing, I think has made over $150 million on opening weekend. I am still pretty confident in saying that it did not come close to this film, even though I haven't witnessed it yet. And I'm sure that it makes me a bad person because I'm not going to go into that with fresh eyes. But I saw the trailer. Like there's a volcano and lava and
Fallen Kingdom. They gotta go there to rescue the dinosaurs because they might die from the volcano. And it's good because Chris Pratt has a very close personal connection with the ones that he raised as his children.
God, if I just have to listen to like another 45 minutes of blue, then I'm gonna lose it. Is there a supercut of him just saying blue over and over again?
You just get one of those little like clickers that they use to see how many people are like in a bar or a restaurant or whatever, and just click it every time he says blue just to see how many times.
Ugh.
So much. I'm gonna go with like 40.
I wanted to do that for every time that Jeff Goldblum said in this film, but I gave up on that one real quick. I don't really have the stamina for that.
Do those both count? Yeah. Or just...
I was going to count both of them.
Mm.
His little pauses. There's also that video of him chuckling to himself on the helicopter for an extended period of time where they just cut back and forth. That was also entertaining.
I'm not sure I've seen that one, but I can imagine. Oh,
I think I saw it through Todd. I have to dig that one up. It was a good one.
All things are possible through Todd.
Todd is the vehicle. He is the deliverer.
He is the glass marble of our world. Anyway, Jurassic Park's good.
Mm-hmm. Time to ride this thing downhill now and go to Lost World. Jurassic Park.